Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. When Barack Obama wrote his first book, he called it Dreams from My Father, the subtitle, A Story of Race and Inheritance. Apparently, he set out to write a mini autobiography, but instead, it turned into something else. To his surprise, Obama later said, he found that he was rediscovering on the page the many ways his father had influenced him, even though his father disappeared from his life at an early age. It was his mother and grandparents who raised him. I heard an interview with him when he was running for president. He talked about the book, and his voice, that voice of the famously low-key, unflappable Obama, faltered. He told of how his mother had died of cancer. And, he said, if he had known she was going to leave this life so soon, he would have written a different kind of book. Who was Obama's mother exactly? What kind of person? How did she, a plain-spoken woman from the Midwest, come to live halfway around the world in a foreign land among a foreign people? What were her beliefs? What was her philosophy? And how do people remember her? Those are the questions posed in today's show. Produced by Judith Kampfner, this is The President's Mother.
Inside a workshop in Yogyakarta, the ancient city of Java, an old puppet maker puts his shadow puppets into a teak box. He's rehearsing his next show. As he lifts one silhouette of a female with long, unruly hair, he beats the side of the box with a stick to tell her story. She's known as Kunti, a mother who bravely sacrifices her son for social justice. Maya Sutoro, Barack Obama's half-sister, was born in Indonesia and lived in Yogyakarta as well as the capital city, Jakarta, for much of her childhood.
I remember the smell of hot wax from the batik makers. I remember the sounds of the animals. I remember the mud floors of the marketplace and the 24 different kinds of chili peppers and plantains. I remember the jamu seller on the corner selling her medicine that could cure every conceivable ailment. And I remember playing badminton with kids from neighboring villages and among the ruins. I spent time at night in my nightgown. It was safe to go watch the dancers perform at the Kraton at the Sultan's Palace, and I would go to the Alon-Alon where they performed the wayang, the shadow puppets, and stay up too late and fall asleep in my mother's lap, and eat food from the people who sold it at the roadside eateries, the warung. So these are all memories that involve a lot of color and cacophony. And so I remember Indonesia as being a very vibrant and multi-textured place.
What had lured Barack and Maya's mother, Anne Dunham, to leave America and go to Indonesia and stay there for much of her adult life? Andrew Vida of Rutgers University met Anne in the mid-60s and remained a close friend. He said it was a kind of restlessness.
A kind of intellectual restlessness, among other things. And she settled into Indonesia and found things that were important to her, and she saw some larger significance in them, I believe.
She was born Stanley Ann Dunham. Stanley because her father wanted a boy. She grew up in Kansas, but the family moved to Hawaii. She wouldn't normally refer to Kansas, according to Andrew Vida, unless she wanted to differentiate herself from people she considered elitists.
Oh, say anthropological colleagues would get off on theoretical flights. Somebody made some remarks which purportedly were above her head, and then she said, well, I'm just an innocent little girl from Kansas. But she was anything but innocent and anything but little, both physically and intellectually.
Intellectually and culturally, it was the University of Hawaii and the renowned East-West Research Center that influenced her, says Anne's close friend, journalist Julia Suryakusuma.
Hawaii afforded her the opportunity to mingle with people from different cultures, and that's when she met her first husband, Barack Obama Sr. And so she was adventurous. At that time, it was quite an amazing thing to do, actually, because it wasn't interracial marriages were not that common.
Imagine an 18-year-old in 1959, a young woman studying anthropology, hungry to know about other races and with a lust to travel. Hawaii was the ideal place for her. Her first husband, whom she married in her teens, was an African academic, and her second, whom she married a few years later, was Javanese.
She was very, very courageous in the decisions that she made, not just professionally, but, for example, in her life also, her choice of marriage partners.
Well, I think the first marriage, as much as I could understand it from her, was intense, someone who's highly intellectual. And the second one, she expected it to be more relaxed, and I knew her second husband and liked him a great deal and spent time with him, but he was not an intense intellectual. He was quite capable in his work, but I think his appeal to her was partly in contrast.
Anne journeyed with her second husband, a civil servant and businessman, Lolo Sotero, to his home in Jakarta when she was 24.
When she came to Indonesia, I mean, the first time in the late 60s, Indonesia was still quite hostile to the West.
One of the new friends Anne made was an Australian, Bronwyn Solomon, who arrived at the same time.
We first went to Indonesia in 1967, and politically it was very unstable. After the terrible 1965 coup, life was very uncertain. And in the streets, you were very aware of military presence. There were dozens of soldiers, and they were armed, in uniform. The effects of the coup lingered and lingered, but were less spoken about.
It was a difficult time, agrees Yang Suwan, an anthropologist who worked with Anne later in her career. As Suwan prepares a huge dish of chili noodles, she says food wasn't easy to come by back then. Maya was born a few years after Anne arrived in Indonesia.
Like she told me, she was in Jogja, and Maya was a baby, chubby baby perhaps. Yeah? And she went to the bakery, and all of the staff of the bakery staff, you know, pinching Maya, oh, how cute, and so on, and giving her fresh bread. And she said, Suwan, at that time, I couldn't even afford to buy that for my child. Yeah. And yeah, I can imagine that time was very hard. Her husband was still a civil servant. And yeah, the payment is very low and also not very regular due to the whole situation, the political situation in Indonesia.
In the midst of turmoil, Anne had to figure out a way how to carve out her career and support her family. She learned Indonesian and Javanese and taught and translated. But she carved out time to coach her son. In Dreams from My Father, Barak describes how his mother got him up early to study. Kay Ikranagara was a teacher in Jakarta who sometimes worked with Anne and whose children were the same age.
She thought it was very important that he do well. She may have felt that the school he was in was not challenging at all for him. And she wanted to make sure that he got a good education, as well as fitting into the local culture. I think they had a good time together at other times, too. I don't think she was a strict taskmaster, other than seeing that he learned.
Barry, they all called Barack Barry then, says Kay, played with Kay's kids.
He was a plump kid with big ears and very outgoing and friendly and easily made friends with people. Indonesian children are given a lot of freedom to run around on their own, especially in the kampongs, and that's urban villages. She was just developing him in all the ways she could. She wanted him to be a leader. I think she saw his father that way and thought that he had the same potential. I think it was important to her that he had high ideals.
Barack got accepted into the elite Punahou school in Hawaii and went to live with his grandparents at the age of 10. A year later, Anne and Maya followed. Maya's father, Lolo, came but didn't stay.
When we lived in Hawaii, for the last 2 years, it was without him because he just couldn't stay. The relationship continued, but the relationship between them was never entirely whole after that.
This was a period of transition for Anne, a son in one country and her daughter's father in another, and the focus of her research in anthropology was now patently very much in Indonesia, where politically and personally her self-image was developing and maturing. She had to make some difficult decisions. So after spending time in Hawaii when Barack was in middle school, she left him in the safe hands of her parents, whom he lovingly called Toots and Gramps. He stayed with them for all his high school years. Maya and Anne returned to Indonesia. So did Anne abandon her son?
To look at my brother as abandoned is to really miss the proverbial forest for the trees. He didn't really belong to Indonesia wholly, and our mother was doing absolutely the best that she could to ensure that he would have freedom of movement if he went to school at this very good school in Hawaii, Punahou. She wanted him to have what was best for him. At the same time, she was in this marriage with an Indonesian, and she had had one failed marriage, but she was still very optimistic about love and really wanted her marriage to succeed. She also really didn't have too much work in Hawaii. So the compromise that she came up with, which arrived after great deliberation and consultation with my brother himself, who declared his preferences quite forcefully, was the only solution that was possible at that time under those circumstances.
He went off to school in Hawaii because there was not a good school that he could attend here at the time. I'm sure any child whose parent sends them off to another place feels some unhappiness about that. And I'm sure it wasn't what she wanted to do. It was something that she felt was best for him. I'm sure he understands that and understood it at the time, too, but that still means, you know, you're living with your grandparents. So I'm sure that was hard. I never heard her say anything negative about Obama's father. She always talked about what a wonderful and amazing person he was.
But did she ever share concerns with you about how is he going to feel at school in Hawaii? There are not many black kids there, that kind of thing.
Both of us were raised in the 60s and felt that there shouldn't be any barriers. You know, she wanted him to be proud of his heritage. Maybe she wasn't aware enough about that. You know, we had this belief that there should be no racial differences, so maybe that made us a little blind to the difficulties that...
Maybe the idealism of the
60s. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Back in Indonesia, living apart from her husband, Anne worked as a project officer for development groups and pursued her postgraduate studies in applied anthropology.
She loved it the most when she worked in the field and she was in contact with the people, with ordinary people. I think there have been a lot of pictures of her shown now in the field talking to somebody making pottery or an ironsmith or whoever. And she was truly at heart an anthropologist, you know, in that respect. She was always looking for something different, and that combined with her desire to help people led her to do the things that she did. So it wasn't just being an anthropologist studying other people's lives. No, I mean, she did very, very practical things. She worked at Ford Foundation. She worked at the Women's World Banking. She worked for the BRI, that's People's Bank of the Republic of Indonesia. So, and this is a bank that was intended for providing microcredit for the poor people. So it was all these institutions that were for the people, truly for the people, and she really, really cared.
Microcredit is now an accepted economic tool in developing countries, but at the time this was pioneering work, and Anne was in the field helping to set up these programs. These schemes helped village leaders in areas where there were no traditional banks to organize cooperative lending. Anne was becoming established in Jakarta as someone at the hub of foreign aid workers and diplomatic social life. Julia picked up some photo albums of holidays she'd spent with Anne. This photo of a group at a party was taken after 1980, when Lolo and Anne were officially divorced.
After her divorce from Lolo Sutoro, her Indonesian husband, this is her second husband, she was a free woman, you know, and she expressed that in a way a woman does. She was, because she was very forgiving, sometimes I'd question some of her choices of friends.
What about her choices of men? Did you sometimes think she should have had a bit more discriminating?
Yes. That's all I'm willing to say.
It was a complicated struggle, balancing social life, family on two continents, grants and projects in many countries. Anne's daughter Maya, who is today an educator and writer, says her mother's passion was to help women become more disciplined, independent and confident.
She did always focus on women and children. Her mission was to help them gain a sense of autonomy and to empower them to aspire to things that seemed initially to be beyond the scope of their future. Helping women to walk alone, if necessary, was very important to her. Not that she would minimize the importance of a family, and not that she was disinterested in helping men. She often worked with whole families and larger communities on microfinance issues. And when she did her research, her anthropological research, very often she worked with traditionally male communities. But I will say that if there was one mission that she had, it was to improve the economic lives of women.
And you went out into the field with her, didn't you? Did you take notes and take photographs for her, anything like that?
I didn't take notes. She took notes, and I was quite young.
It wasn't easy to be a divorced working woman in Indonesia, and Anne travelled a good deal.
For the most part, I was homeschooled by my mother. She was my teacher till I turned 12, and we lived in Semarang and Jogja and other places, but we would very often travel. So she would teach me in the morning. I used a correspondence course. She used friends and her own expertise to sort of impart all that I needed. And it actually served me well until high school.
Here's a typical letter that Anne sent from Indonesia to her beloved professor and mentor, Alice Dewey, in Hawaii.
You may remember that I am handling projects for Ford in the area of women, employment, and industry, small and large. This year I have major projects for handloom weavers in West Timor,
for shop girls along Jalan Malioboro and market sellers and slum dwellers in Jakarta and Bandung, and for street food sellers in Thailand. In addition, I am still team teaching the sociology of the family course at Bogor Agricultural University, and I am project specialist on a research project on the roles of rural women on the outer islands of Indonesia.
When you came down and saw her having breakfast at 7 in the morning, she'd already put in a four-hour day at work, and so she could, you know, could relax for a bit. People just didn't understand how hardworking she was or how with grace she took that kind of workload.
Setting up and monitoring projects. In April, the foundation is sending me to Bangladesh for an employment conference. I am hoping to take Maya with me, in lieu of home leave this year, and stop off in Thailand on the way there and Delhi on the way back.
Community leaders often refer to her as an Orang Besar, a great person. But Jakarta Post writer Julia Suryakusuma says to her face, people called her Ibu Anne. Mother Anne.
She was quite matronly as well. She was quite big physically. And she'd tell me about times when people who hadn't seen her for a long time would comment, "Oh, Bu Anne, you've become even fatter now, haven't you?" You know, which is a very Indonesian thing. And she'd be a bit annoyed, but it didn't really bother her too much. Yeah.
A development worker from Holland, living in Jakarta, Marionette Uman, who collaborated with Anne briefly on some women's projects, said you couldn't forget her.
Plain and strong, and didn't care about clothing, didn't care about hair, didn't care about anything. but she was marvelous because she didn't care. It's not that she was careless. That's not what I'm saying. But she, there was no makeup, no nothing. She was just beautiful. As she was earth woman with the feet in the earth. That's what I mean.
Barak doesn't have Anne's body shape, says friend Kay Ikranagara. But he has similar features.
His long face actually has a very similar shape to hers. Quite a long chin. You know, I think everyone in the family, Maya too, are all very warm, and that's part of her personality.
My brother and I both are starting to look more like her. I share her plumpness.
And the eyebrows.
And the eyebrows, yeah. Very dark hair and dark eyes.
And the thing about that, she has some Cherokee blood?
Yes, well, the story always was that we had a great-great-grandmother who was a full-blooded Cherokee, and that there was some, the scandal.
Her thick, wild hair was something many Indonesians remarked on. For 1 year, Anne rented a room in an extended family's home so that she could be nearer the blacksmith community she was studying. Her landlady was Maggie Norabangun.
One time when she was home, I asked her, how come your hair is so funny? She said, don't you know, I have blood running in me from the Cherokee Indian tribe.
Anne was self-possessed, a lodger who played gamelan cassettes in her room, but was quiet and polite, says Maggie. In the year she stayed there, she never talked about her personal life, but you could see she missed her children by the attention she paid to Maggie's boy and girl. Today, the current border still has the same narrow iron twin bed, and there are cracks from several earthquakes in the walls of her room. The toilet is down a long corridor round a courtyard where large pet turtles scrabble in the earth.
Make sure so comfortable in the bathroom, despite of its traditional condition like that. And what
meaning
time,
what? That, what do you mean traditional?
Did we have the closet yet?
No, not yet.
Not yet. You had to how do you call it? Squat?
Maggie remembers that early in the morning, Anne would scoop up tempeh crumbs from the pan and rush out onto a motor scooter, hitching up her batik skirts to continue her research on the ancient rituals of blacksmithing. This family remembers Anne joining in their chores, helping to sieve the cassava flour to make the paste for cooking. Her legacy in the area of microfinancing is finally paying off. This family-run business, Meerman Metals, has got a loan to buy more charcoal.
They have been loaned it for 1.5 years now.
So it's quite new.
Mm-hmm. So they get the information mouth to mouth from one to another, and one by one they started to get a loan.
The women in this family used to work the bellows, but there's no need to do that now. They've just got a loan themselves to sell clothes in the market. It took Anne Dunham 14 years to earn her PhD because she combined her research with her work for development agencies. That both funded her research and was part of the activism she valued. Anthropologists can provide important information, explains Professor Dewey.
The size of the loan and the time of repayment have to be a result of your knowing exactly all the processes in making whatever it is. In blacksmithing, from the time you buy the raw iron to the time you make it, sell it, and get the money can be 5 or 6 weeks. And then you say to the World Bank, you know, these guys need 6 weeks to pay this off.
I think the microcredit work was very important. The Ford Foundation work supporting the NGOs was important, and her dissertation, she was studying how the village industries were actually still economically viable and important.
Anne Dunham obviously compartmentalized her life, only rarely crossing over between professional and personal. Once, for example, with a fellow anthropologist, Nancy Cooper, in Honolulu.
Jesse Jackson
had spoken there. This would have been in the late 80s. And Anne mentioned her son, and she mentioned her first husband. And she just became very excited about the things her son was interested in, about Jesse Jackson himself. So I learned more about her earlier background that I really had not seen as a colleague before.
You've described, I think the word that you used, your childhood as untethered.
I didn't describe my childhood as untethered. I could understand how my brother might want to give his children more solidity, more of a reliable and predictable childhood than the one that he had, and he might think that his childhood was untethered. I mean, I think with our mother traveling so much and with him living in various places and living with our grandparents and seeing Mom during holidays and summers, my brother, in spite of the imperfection of the way he was raised, knows that our mother loved him. She was very steady about expressing it. She was very affectionate. She was doting. She was all of those things. My feeling is that he enjoyed a very grounded sense of love.
Anne Dunham died of ovarian cancer in 1995. She went back to Hawaii for her last year.
If she were alive, I think people would see her generosity and her curiosity. At the same time, you would have a lot of people who would say that, you know, her marriages were failures, that she wasn't a proper homemaker, and that sort of thing is inevitable. You would have detractors.
Do you think she would have made speeches for him? Would she have campaigned for him?
Sure. Sure, I think she would have. She would have probably gotten good at it. She was someone who inspired many with her voice. I think she was charismatic, and I think she was memorable, and I know that she would have been able to move others. And to some degree, my brother gets his charm and charisma from her example.
The President's Mother was produced by Judith Kampfner. The show was mixed by Jared Weisbrot. If you missed part of today's episode and want to hear it again, visit our website, soundprint.org, where you can listen to programs and catch up on some reading material. That address again is soundprint.org. Soundprint CDs are available for purchase for a small fee. Call us toll-free at 1-888-38-TAPES, and we'll send you your favorite episodes. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. We love hearing from you. Drop us a line at talkback@soundprint.org, and don't forget to mention your local station. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.